Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, August 30th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Noah Asimo and Will Sennett from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and we'll check in with WCAI's own Sarah Mises-Tan and Eve Zuckoff. Now, look at some of the news here around the Cape and the Islands. Kristen, the nonprofit Cape Cod Child Development is closing all its programs. The surprise announcement left parents and employees asking a lot of questions and wondering what's next. And now there's word that a federal audit of the agency will be taking place.
Yes, there's really been this resounding question of why Cape Cod Child Development pulled the plug on preschool, after and before school care, and family daycare programs that are licensed by the State Department of Early Education and Care. The agency was already slated to give up its state licenses to operate two preschools on Falmouth and Hyannis. Those closures had been confirmed last week, but officials in charge of Cape Cod Child Development didn't respond to calls from Times reporters this week, but a financial expert who had been hired by the agency confirmed Tuesday that the agency is terminating all of its programs. And this was really was once a really well-respected organization. It served up to 3,000 children and families and had a $13 million budget. It did start to make headlines, though, earlier this year when it lost its long-standing federal contract to operate Head Start programs after investigators found that it had sort of overshot that budget and was wallowing in credit card debt. And meanwhile, key staff and teacher positions were going vacant. We spoke with some employees who wanted to remain anonymous this week, and they said there are still children in school and that these employees weren't really told, either in person or through a letter, that they may be out of a job or that they are out of a job, that all that they had heard was by word of mouth. Another employee said that the agency sort of took a downturn with the hiring of a new executive director in 2015. That director apparently had no early childhood education experience at all and had started eliminating upper management and teaching positions. She was replaced, however, a month after the Office of Head Start made a monitoring visit to Cape Cod Child Development in July of last year, but the agency continued to experience problems. And now, as you mentioned, auditors from the Inspector General's office are taking a close look at the way that the agency ran that Head Start program.
This program serves a real need in the community, and families receive vouchers and subsidies for the educational programs and the child development programs that come through this. What's going to happen to these programs that this was administering?
So there are several other agencies that have stepped up to take on some of these other programs. Social Community Action Council announced Thursday that it will be assuming control of 7 child care and preschool programs that were operated by Cape Cod Child Development. And those are in Hyannis, Falmouth, Centerville, West Yarmouth, and Dennisport. So you can really see this. There's a broad reach across the Cape of families who are involved with this and have children who really rely on these services. Jack Cocchio, who's CEO of the Action Council, said he doesn't know really when the transition from Cape Cod Child Development will take place, but the council is working to have continuity of care for families and kids who are attending those programs. The Kennedy Donovan Center also announced on Wednesday that agency has permission from the State Department of Public Health to take on infants and toddlers in the early intervention program, which was previously run by Cape Cod Child Development. And they'll also be assuming some of that staff, some or all of that early intervention staff, according to an official from Kennedy Donovan. The Community Development Institute of Denver is working to restore Head Start programs on the Cape and Islands. The Institute took the reins of the local Head Start program on July 1st, and that was a day after Cape Cod Child Development's contract to operate that program ended, which sort of happened after that whole report last year. So,
let's talk about Triple E across the Cape. This is the mosquito-borne virus. It's been detected now in Truro after being found in 2 other towns on the Cape. Public health officials are urging people to remain vigilant about avoiding mosquito bites. And this all comes after a Fairhaven woman died of the virus, apparently over the weekend.
Yes. So this mosquito sampling taken at the Cape Cod National Seashore tested positive for Eastern Equine Encephalitis, and that makes it the first time that that virus has been detected in Truro. The sample was taken August 22nd at Head of the Meadow, and the disease was actually found in a species of mosquito that's deemed to be pretty aggressive. It bites animals and humans and feeds from dawn to dusk. Falmouth was the first town on the Cape Harbor to have mosquitoes test positive for EE this summer. And the virus there showed up in 7 pools of insects collected in Woods Hole and Falmouth Center. The town did some truck-mounted spraying a week or two ago that it seems to have worked pretty well. There have been no infected mosquitoes that have been found since that time. Also, EE had been found in a pool of mosquitoes collected on August 13th in Bourne. And these mosquitoes are rare on the Cape. EEE has only been found here in mosquitoes 4 other times in the past 2 decades, and that was in Dennis and Barnstable in 2006 and in Brewster in 2012 and Yarmouth in 2016. This year, though, has really proven kind of prolific for these infested mosquitoes. EEE has been found in 376 pools of mosquitoes around the state, compared with just 2 positive samples last year. And you know, it's a pretty serious disease. The Department of Public Health now considers dozens of Massachusetts towns to be at critical or high risk of EEE, which has a 50% mortality rate in the state. And those who do survive generally have lifelong neurological symptoms. And every town on the Cape, though, is considered at low risk, except for Falmouth, Bourne, and Truro, where the department has deemed that there's a moderate risk. So far this summer, 4 people have been stricken by the virus. One of them was 59-year-old Lori Sylvia of Fairhaven. She died on Sunday, and that's the first time a Massachusetts resident has died of the virus since 2012. There has never been a case of human infection here on Cape Cod, though. The officials are saying that mosquito populations are starting to decline with cooler weather, but still, with this prevalence of the disease, there's a higher likelihood now than ever that a mosquito you see out there could be carrying the disease. So they're warning people to still take some precautions. That means wearing an EPA-approved mosquito repellent for outdoor activities. They also say if you're engaging in outdoor activities during those high-risk times, sort of in the evening or the early morning, you might want to reschedule that to a time when there are less likely to be mosquitoes outside.
And this mosquito threat kind of lingers now until the first frost, is what they say. So it's even as the weather is getting a little bit cooler, we still need to be vigilant.
That's right.
The towns of Dennis and Yarmouth, they could soon be signing off on a new school agreement. Anyone who follows this local news and the news roundup knows that it's been a fraught journey to this point, and at times quite an acrimonious journey.
That's right. This has been a long time coming. Now these 2 special town meetings might solidify these 2 major changes to the Dennis-Yarmouth Regional School District's regional agreement, and that has been a source of heated dispute between the partner towns for years, if not decades. All of this is sort of coming to a head in what seemed like very quick votes. There was a meeting that lasted just 16 minutes on Monday of the DY School Committee.
Just 16 minutes.
It was called. I think that was the only, there might have been one other thing on the agenda. It was super fast. The committee voted unanimously to approve language for an article that would make 2 revisions to the regional agreement and request that the article be placed on the warrants for special town meetings to be held on October 29th. They'll both be held on the same day. And then minutes later, in the same room, the Dennis Board of Selectmen opened its own meeting and voted to place the article on the warrant and to recommend it to voters. Yarmouth Board of Selectmen did the same thing separately on Tuesday.
And this was because they had already agreed on pretty much everything that was here, right?
That's right. The content of those updates had been stipulated in a settlement agreement reached by both towns and the school district last month. That settlement had resolved a lawsuit filed in February by the town of Yarmouth that contended that the school district didn't have the authority to bypass town meeting action when it sought to get approval for this new $170 million, that's a big difference, regional middle school last year. But people are saying, you know, the approval method wasn't really the point of the lawsuit here, that the real reason Yarmouth filed suit was because of the inability of the towns to get this regional agreement updated. So the fact that they're doing so now is a pretty big deal. The settlement agreement stipulated that both boards of selectmen need to advocate for these 2 changes, which will kind of shift the amount that Dennis pays. It will actually require Dennis to pay a little bit more for annual school operating costs by calling on that town to change the way enrollment is counted, so it kind of is a more accurate reflection of how much Dennis really owes. The other major change here calls on Dennis to pay for more of construction of the new school. It would boost its share from about 29%, which is what it would owe under the current 50% agreement to 35%. Mm-hmm. And when you consider that it is a $117 million project, those few percentage points really do add up. Yarmouth's share would come down from about 70% down to 65%. And in return for these updates, which still have to be approved by town meeting and they still have to be approved by the state Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, Yarmouth did in fact drop that lawsuit against the new school. And so now it's much more likely that the school will get to be built. It will still qualify for this $44.3 million
reimbursement. Which was a big deal. There was $44 million from the state sitting out there that they had to sign this agreement. And it came down to the last few hours to negotiate these details.
Yes, this settlement happened literally hours before a state deadline for resolving the lawsuit. And if it hadn't been resolved, then the district would have lost out on this $44.3 million reimbursement. Things aren't quite in the clear yet, though. There is another lawsuit out there that's been filed.
I was going to ask you, this is from residents of Yarmouth.
Yes, from two Yarmouth residents. It contends a lot of the same things that are in the that were in Yarmouth's lawsuit as well, saying that the school district didn't have the authority to bypass town meeting action. However, the state school building authority has said that they're going to stick by the district and they will be still in the running to receive this $44.3 million reimbursement. The project's just on hold until that litigation plays out.
And now the feeling in the towns, everybody's just waiting for this town meetings to go by and they can like put a check mark next to all of this.
Yes. Yeah, it does still have to get passed in both towns. And you never really know what could happen. I think there have been a lot of parents who've come out in support of these changes and saying we need to move on from some of these disagreements that we've had in the past and that this is all, you know, for the good of the children. So We'll have to see. Wait and see.
Dennis and Yarmouth are also involved in a potential three-way collaboration, this time with Harwich, over wastewater. And it's a big issue that every Cape town has to grapple with. These three towns are getting closer, it sounds like, to an agreement on a three-way collaborative to deal with their wastewater.
Yeah, so this is something these three towns have been working on for about 3 years now. And there's a big push to get them to work together on this project for treating wastewater because it could stand to save the towns about a combined $70 million over each installing their own individual wastewater treatment plant. And what this plan would do is it would take wastewater from all three towns and it would treat it at a central plant in South Dennis. The towns themselves would be responsible for paying for their own collection systems, but the savings really comes in on the plant itself. Rather than having three plants, you only have one. They'll also save millions each year, supposedly, in annual operating costs of the plant. There'd been a big push to try to get this done and approved in time for a fall town meeting, but in respective meetings on Monday and Tuesday, the Harwich and Yarmouth Boards of Selectmen discussed whether to put that article that would actually create the partnership on the town meeting warrants. And there was some hesitation there. In Harwich, Selectman Chairman Larry Ballantyne said that Harwich just isn't quite ready for that yet, that they haven't had a lot of the public meetings that are necessary to move this forward, that there are still some questions on costs, and those costs have been kind of a moving target. It's still unclear what exactly that would mean. And there is some legislation ongoing that would create this partnership. That passed the House of Representatives ahead of schedule last week.
This has to be approved by the state.
Yes.
Not just the towns individually, but then this compact, this three-way compact, has to be approved by the state.
Exactly. This has to go through law to even allow the towns to make an agreement. What would happen is this bill would create this entity. It would give it authority to tax, actually, to spend in money and incur debt. And what the agreement itself, not the legislation, would dictate kind of how that partnership works, how each town contributes, what its percentage is, and how they'd be represented on this.
So the towns get to decide how the agreement works,
yes.
But it has to be incorporated by the state or enabled by the state. Yes.
Exactly. And there's a question on whether that legislation would even be ready in time for a set of fall town meetings. It did pass through the House ahead of schedule, but it resides with the Senate now. And the thought is that maybe there's a chance that this legislation could come through by early October. These town meetings, though, would be scheduled for October 29th. So, if there was any sort of delay or things didn't move as quickly as they're hoping, that could create some real problems because the towns wouldn't be allowed to vote on the agreement until the actual bill is in place.
And not only that, as you were pointing out earlier, there's a feeling among the towns that there's some more education that has to be done here for the citizens, for people to understand what this is about and why they should be voting for it or what the questions are to raise around this.
Yeah, that's true. I think a lot of the selectmen in both towns still didn't even know themselves exactly what these costs would be and how this would really work. In Yarmouth, there were new calculations that reflect the potential build-out of businesses along Route 28. And that pushed the amount that Yarmouth was expected to send to the plant, which pushed its cost from about $113 million to $126 million. And that's just for the first phase. Town Administrator Daniel Knapik said that those aren't developments that are good to occur so late in the game, so close to this town meeting. In Harwich, which would contribute just about 15% of the plant's flow, the price of installing the pipes, though, to get the sewage to Dennis would bring the total cost of involvement for that town to about $270 million. It's a big project.
But right, when you point out these numbers, you were talking about a $70 million savings and $270 million, but the whole project could be a billion-dollar project.
Yeah, and it would take about 40 years to implement. So we're not talking about, you know, a small town project. This is something that's bigger than most of these towns have ever seen individually.
But the towns actually are obligated, they're obliged to do something about their wastewater here. This isn't just sort of being proactive for the sake of doing something good. This is the state is holding them to account here, right?
That's right. The towns are, as they're working on this joint effort, they're also each working on their own sort of go-it-alone strategies. And that's because doing nothing is not an option. CAPE communities have been directed by the Department of Environmental Protection to participate in what's known
as
the DEP, the 208 plan. And that mandates towns to work together to find cost-effective solutions for dealing with water quality issues. And if they don't act, the department could actually require individual homeowners to install enhanced treatment systems for septic systems. Litigation is also another possibility if towns don't comply.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times has been Kristen Young. Kristen, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining us on the phone now from the Vineyard Gazette is Noah Asimo. Good morning, Noah.
Good morning, Steve.
Noah, the problems at the Tisbury School got a public airing this week with parents turning out to express their frustration and anger. This is after lead contamination was detected in the old school building. There was a meeting Tuesday night. Tell us about the meeting and what it was like. Who was there?
Yeah, so this is a really tough situation. We're pretty much watching a crisis unfold. It was a joint meeting between the Tisbury School Board and the Board of Selectmen. And it was packed. It was absolutely packed. Parents came to pretty much air frustrations, concerns, some of them logistical questions, some of them much more than that, at the leaders that they feel have let them down and let this situation get to a point that it probably never should have. I mean, a lot of the anger and frustration that was expressed at the meeting goes back much further than just lead contamination that they found out about last week.
Jump in and just bring us up to speed about what the situation is at the school, what they found and what they're looking at to try to resolve this.
Well, a report was made public on Monday about the lead contamination. Basically, what was found was that a lot of the paint in the school had been chipping, and the administrators had known about lead in the school for a long time, but it had never been a problem because it was intact. Now that stuff seems loose. The school seems like it's deteriorating at a fast rate. And when in the report, I mean, it pretty much lays it out very clearly. I think 12 classrooms had lead, including shared use spaces like the cafeteria, like the bathrooms, like the music room. And that lead was at, in some rooms, you know, it was just slightly above the OSHA threshold. In others, it was 18 or 19 times the OSHA threshold. So there was a lot of anger from parents. If you'd known about the lead problem, why weren't steps taken to remediate it? School officials say, as they've expressed throughout this process, that it really had never been expressed to them that it was a problem until most recently. So it's kind of just like everything is snowballed to this point. And logistically, it's resulted in the delay of school and kids having to be moved to at least the fifth or eighth graders are going to be going to the high school. Initially, the plan was to have the kindergarten through fourth graders at a different facility, but now they're going to be kept in a section of the school that's newer and doesn't have lead paint. So there's kind of just a whole tangle of logistics associated with this, and I think parents, just the same as the school board, are sort of scrambling to figure it out.
And all of this is coming after the town voted not to build a new school just last year, and that vote was a very, very close vote.
Right, right. So that's a lot of the context for the anger and frustration from parents and from members of the school board, too. And that was what was sort of aired on Tuesday night at this really crowded meeting. I mean, you have parents lining the walls and sitting on the floor, and they were calling on selectmen to resign because the school vote, well, while it passed at town meeting, ended up getting voted down at the ballot box by 20 votes. So it was this very close vote. One selectman was opposed to it. Another selectman didn't take a stance on it, which I think also frustrated parents.
There was a sense that the select board had not backed this initiative for a new school.
Exactly. They felt they hadn't backed the initiative, and they felt that because they hadn't backed the initiative, it then got voted down at the ballot box, even though it was overwhelmingly approved at town meeting. And I think that parents are seeing this kind of as a moment. Everything's coming to a head. It's a climax of that frustration that they had for many months, really a long time.
What happens now with the plan is for the students to go to the high school, as you said, and into the new wing of the building, but then all this has to be remediated. All the lead has to be dealt with.
Right. So it's complicated now. The initial plan was that they were going to remediate immediately. That's why they wanted to get all the kids out of the school. Now it seems like that might not be the case. The school board and the superintendent seem to be at least initially in favor of saying, hey, look, we've got the kids out of the building. Let's now try and pursue this building project again. And why would we spend $1 million to try and remediate this lead paint issue if we're going to have to ultimately do a much larger renovation on the building itself? I mean, the building has had health reports that have said it has moisture issues, it has ventilation issues, and issues that go beyond just this one of chipping lead paint. Mm-hmm. And selectmen have set a date of September 24th for a special town meeting. They're going to allocate over $1 million for modular classrooms to come. But, you know, it's going to take a long time. It's probably going to be 3 or 4 months, even until the modular classrooms are available and ready to go. And at that point, I think a lot of the teachers, or at least a lot, not teachers, but parents, school staff, and school officials are thinking, well, if the kids are going to be in the modular classrooms anyway, you know, why don't we use this as an opportunity to try and push for the school project we've wanted for all these years?
Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, we're going to do something different here. The Gazette has another story I want to talk about, so I'm just going to ask you to pass the phone to reporter Will Sennett, who should be standing there. Thanks, Noah.
Here we go. Passing the phone.
Will Sennett, are you there?
Hey, Steve. How's it going?
Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Morning.
Well, on Wednesday this week, a man set out to do something terribly daunting, to swim from Nantucket to Martha's Vineyard. You covered this story. Tell us who this is and why he was doing this.
Yeah, so I traveled to Nantucket with Doug McConnell and his team, A-Long Swim. A-Long Swim is a family-based nonprofit organization dedicated to raising funds for ALS research. And we set out to Nantucket for the first attempt anyone has made to swim the 18-mile channel from Nantucket to Martha's Vineyard.
Now, he's going to swim from Nantucket to Martha's Vineyard. You rode along on the boat that accompanied him. Is that right?
I did. Yep. I rode along on the boat. Unfortunately, he did not make the swim. Came very close. The conditions on Wednesday were rough. And we were actually supposed to leave on Monday, but got delayed due to weather.
I see. And then on Wednesday, though, he did set out on this swim. And this is like not only just an endurance test for him, but even as he was setting out, he was starting to get stung by jellyfish. He's setting out Monday morning early.
Yeah, jellyfish were a serious concern for the swim. At first, we were more concerned about sharks in the water. He was wearing a shark deterrent device. But, jellyfish seemed to be the biggest challenge in the swim. By the end of it, he had almost 100 jellyfish stings, lion's mane jellyfish. And it was only made worse by the fact that he's actually allergic to jellyfish.
Can you describe just a little bit of the route for us and some of the challenges? We know that there's jellyfish and sharks, but this is a very tricky waterway to try to swim.
Yeah, so he launched off Eel Point in Nantucket. He was going to go northwest around Muskeget Island and push up further northwest to Cape Pogue, wrap around the Cape Pogue Lighthouse, dip down to Egertown Harbor, and land on the Egertown Lighthouse. The first leg of the journey was calm and clear, but once we reached Muskeget Island, about 3 miles off where we launched off at Eel Point, we were hit with strong winds and a strong southeast current, and Doug pushed on for another 14 miles despite the current and conditions, and ultimately made it another 14 miles. But the swim was called off by his wife, Susan, and the two boat captains just 150 yards off Waisqui Point in Chappaquiddick.
So he came within 150 yards of the shore there.
Yeah, 150 yards. It was actually close enough to see people fishing off the beach. Not quite close enough to see the types of lures they were using, but close enough.
So by that little measure, perhaps he fell short. But this was an amazing accomplishment. And by the bigger measure of what he did raising money here, it was also tremendously successful.
Yeah, though he didn't complete the swim, it was still successful. Doug said his main goal was to raise money for ALS research, a neurological disorder that has deeply affected his family. And the swim raised over $80,000 for ALS research. And yeah, Doug's done this for over a decade. And he swam, you know, the English Channel, Hawaiian Islands. He swam around Manhattan.
Mm.
And over his, you know, the past decade, he's raised over $600,000 for ALS research. So this isn't just a one-off event. He's really dedicated to this fundraising.
Will Sennett at the Vineyard Gazette. Will, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much, Steve. Appreciate it.
We are going to speak right now with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, in Harwich, a 10-year-old boy feels strongly enough about a village improvement that he sent his own money to the state to try to move things along. Tell us about this.
Sure. 10-year-old summer resident Pete Lipscomb sent Governor Charlie Baker $50 that Pete raised from selling lemonade this summer. And he asked that the money be used to start a fund to build sidewalks along Route 28 between Harwich Port and Sacquetucket Harbor. In a letter to the governor, Pete said he'd like to be able to walk or ride his bike to visit his grandparents who live in that area, but he can't because along that stretch of Route 28, not only do vehicles travel at a usually very fast rate of speed, there is literally no shoulder for pedestrians to use. In some spots, there's just 1 foot or so between the roadway and hedges and fences and other impediments along the side of the road. And that prevents pedestrians from safely walking the road in that stretch. Now, this isn't news to officials in Harwich. They've wanted sidewalks along this area for years. But as you know, Route 28 is a state highway, so it's up to the Massachusetts Highway Department to make improvements there. A few years ago, the state told the town that sidewalks would be upgraded the next time they did work on Route 28 in that area, and the town went ahead and appropriated money for its share of the sidewalk work. But ultimately, the costs turned out to be way more than anticipated, something like $800,000, and the town had only appropriated a couple hundred thousand. The town sought a state grant to try to help with that funding, but the grant was rejected. Now, town officials have continued to push for the sidewalks, but now they've been joined by Pete and actually another resident named Susan Tomek, who actually walked part of that road with Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito on Tuesday. Now, Lieutenant Governor was in town to hold a completion ceremony for the recent improvements to Sacquetucket Harbor, which the Seaport Economic Council, which she chairs, contributed about $2 million. But afterwards, Tomek took Polito on a little walk. They discussed the sidewalk. And Polito seemed aware of the situation and agreed to see what she could do to connect town officials with the highway, state highway people, to see if there could be some movement on this issue. You know, Sacquetucket Harbor is at sort of one end of this area. Harwich Port is at the other. And for a long time, the town has wanted to really connect the harbor with the business center of the community. And now they have Pete Lipscomb, who's got the governor's ear. The governor actually sent Pete back the money and told him that, you know, he needed to he was glad he was involved in local government. But Pete really wasn't satisfied with that, and he really sent another letter back to the governor suggesting that, you know, there should be a fund set up for this sidewalk, and really emphasizing how dangerous the situation is for pedestrians along that way. So there's some hope that these developments will give some kind of a momentum to this effort, and maybe the state will work a little closer with the town to try to get this get these sidewalks built.
Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for bringing us up to date on that.
Thanks, Steve.
We're going to speak now with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Morning, Steve. How are you?
Casey, I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, too.
The funicular in Provincetown is a big step closer to coming to the town after a lawsuit has been resolved. Maybe you better explain for folks again what the funicular is and why it's being proposed.
Yes, exactly. So this is the so-called Bradford Access Project. And what it is an outdoor inclined elevator. That's what the Pilgrim Memorial Association, which is the owners of the Pilgrim Monument and Provincetown Museum, and also the future owners of the funicular, which is what it's been called for years, because it's basically an outdoor contraption that runs on a rail. It will run 80 feet from the base of the monument on Bradford Street to the top of High Pole Hill. So that's an 80-foot climb. And at that top of that hill, of course, is the Pilgrim Monument, which is 252 feet towering over Provincetown. So it's another grand and bold move coming to P-Town architecturally, and it's not been without controversy. The project has been has gone through 2 years of planning and permitting, and it finally got there. They got their building permit on Friday from the town, and this is 3 weeks after the neighbors who live in the closest neighbors, I might add.
And very close, very close.
Very close, 9 feet away from where the rail tracks are going to be. That's where their property line is. So they settled the lawsuit. We don't know how the details of the settlement aren't disclosed, but the attorney for that neighbor said that they've reached a mutual agreement. And so who knows how that happened. But anyway, now it looks like the inclined elevator is going to happen. Construction is expected to take 9 months. They're going out, they're getting their final construction bids right now. And 9 months later, perhaps there will be this unique inclined elevator at the bottom of the monument to take residents and visitors up to the monument.
And this is
kind of outrageous.
This is part of the Provincetown 400 envisioning. Is this right?
Yes, indeed. So the hope is to have this project completed by May or June of next year, which is, of course, at the time when Provincetown will be a focus of international attention because it's the 400th anniversary of the landing of the Mayflower Pilgrims. And at one point, the town was expecting to have the seated president come and visit, which is what happened and perhaps someone from the royal family, which is what happened in the 400th anniversary of the Jamestown colony a few years earlier. So it's going to be a very huge celebration in Provincetown, and the hope is to have this not be a construction zone when that occurs.
Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining us on the phone right now is George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, there's been a lot of coverage of the lead issues at Tisbury School, and you've been covering that at the Times, but you've also followed up on another lead contamination story, and one that's already resulted in two children being diagnosed with elevated lead levels. This has to do with Coast Guard housing. Tell us about this.
Right. This is Coast Guard housing at West Chop Light, and this all emerged about a year ago. Two children there had elevated blood levels of lead in their system, and the Coast Guard decided to move them out immediately and find other housing for the two families involved. But it turns out the Coast Guard knew about this, and as listeners might remember last week, this was talked about by Brittany Bowker on the Roundup. This week we're talking about this again because 400 pages of documents have been released by the Coast Guard, something that our reporter, Rich Salzberg, who's been on this from the get-go, had been asking for, had to appeal several times in order to get them released. And these, in plain writing, show that the Coast Guard knew that there was lead contamination in these two homes and didn't properly notify the families of the risks involved. Steve, things like it was the lead was in a child's bedroom in one instance, and they also found lead in a child's toy box, and that was likely, because it had been moving around with the child, maybe on their feet or on their hands or something like that. So pretty significant issue here. And as we reported last week, this has led the Coast Guard to put some new protocols in place in terms of checking out Coast Guard housing across the country, what happened here at West Chop. So pretty significant story. And, hats off to Rich Salzberg for really digging deep into this and, not taking no for an answer from the federal government each time he asked for these documents and appealed.
The documents also mentioned asbestos on the property.
That's right. There is asbestos located there as well. So, some of the same issues they're dealing with right across town at Tisbury School they're dealing with in this Coast Guard housing. Of course, no one is living in this housing at this time, and the Coast Guard is in the process of figuring out what they want to do with it, whether they want to, remediate the issues there and perhaps, in the future use it for housing. Of course, the reason they did put people back into this housing is that there is such a housing crisis on Martha's Vineyard. It affects the working people here, and Coast Guard are not immune to it because, they're stationed at Station Menempsha here, and there's a lack of housing for them as well.
George, it's that time of the summer. It's time for us to talk about Alan Dershowitz. He's speaking about his latest book, and no surprise, perhaps, there's controversy involved here.
Yeah, the headline we used is Cloud of Controversy Follows Alan Dershowitz, and isn't that the truth? He does have a home here on the island, and he is promoting another book this summer, and he was looking for a place to do that. West Tisbury said yes. Some people are upset that West Tisbury Library. And some people are upset that the library did that. But as the library director says, it's not their role to decide who gets to use the space and who doesn't. They open it up to everyone, and controversial or not. And so there are some people who are threatening to protest this because of Alan Dershowitz's defense of Donald Trump, and also, as many people probably know, he was a friend and an attorney of Jeffrey Epstein, the person who was accused of sex trafficking and died in jail recently. So there's a lot of controversy that follows Alan Dershowitz. He takes on high-profile defendants and in some cases gets them off when people think that those people are guilty. That's his job, and some people don't like that, and it's going to be interesting to see how this all turns out. Dershowitz did speak to us, said he's not going to shy away from any tough questions. He also claimed that the Chilmark Library had banned him, but the library director there was pretty upset about that. She said he wasn't banned. He was told that, they simply couldn't accommodate him at the time he wanted to be there. One of the main reasons being he does attract a big crowd.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Steve. Have a good weekend.
You too. And now we're joined by WCAI reporter Sarah Mises-Tan. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
Sarah, you cover so many stories for us here. I'm going to ask you today to update us on a couple of them. This week, you had a story on the National NPR about Cape Cod and sharks. And you were really kind of rounding up what the summer feels like as this first summer after a fatal shark attack on the Cape last September. Everybody probably remembers Arthur Medici was killed by a shark at Newcomb Hollow Beach. Tell us, what's the shark situation been like these past few weeks, and what are some of the changes that people might notice on the outer Cape beaches?
Sure, yeah. So it's been a banner month for sharks on the Cape. Lifeguards at outer Cape beaches have been regularly calling people out of the water, sometimes up to a couple times a day just because of shark sightings. There are much bigger signs. There are much taller lifeguard chairs. There are mobile EMT teams. very likely, if you've been out to an Outer Cape beach, you have probably noticed a number of these changes. And of course, the biggest news that maybe you might not have noticed is the addition of a new shark buoy installed off the coast of Newcomb Hollow Beach, the beach where, like you said, Arthur Medici was killed just under a year ago.
So tell us about this buoy. What's special about this buoy?
This is an important distinction, because we've heard a whole lot about different kinds of buoys and different proposals to put different buoys in the water.
These are detection buoys.
Yeah, this buoy was installed by Greg Skomel and the state. It's a buoy that detects tagged sharks only. Skomel and his researchers have tagged about 300 sharks so far, which sounds like a whole lot, but he's noted a number of times that 300 is just a slice of the shark population that visits the Cape. But of course, this buoy will pick those sharks up if they are passing by, which is, of course, a good thing.
Other towns we've heard have previously said no to shark buoys. What were the concerns there?
Yeah, there have been a lot of proposals during town meetings earlier this year for shark buoys that wouldn't just pick up tagged sharks, but would also detect shark-like movements in the water and alert lifeguards. But town officials have said that that kind of technology is still unproven and it's expensive. I spoke with Suzanne Grout-Thomas, who said there are two things to take into consideration when looking at new technology. One, you want to make sure it's accurate. You don't want to be falsely alarming people of sharks if there isn't really a shark in the water. And two, having towns install buoys isn't as easy as just putting a buoy in the water. She mentioned that there's a lot of different levels of permitting that would have to be gotten, since a buoy will float on the surface of the water, but it would be anchored in the seabed. And she says the town of Wellfleet is in charge of the sand on the beach. The National Seashore is in charge of the water right off the beach, but the state owns the seabed. And then, of course, there's the Coast Guard to take into consideration, too. So just putting a buoy out there is not going to be a quick and easy task.
Now, I have the Sharktivity app on my phone, and it sends an alert when a beach is closed to swimming for a confirmed shark sighting. And it does seem like it dings with a new alert almost every day and often a couple of times a day. Overall, how do people seem to be feeling about all this increased shark activity?
You know, when I was out there recently, it did look like there were still a good number of people boogie boarding, surfing, and swimming out in the water, which seems a little worrisome. Mm-hmm. But I did talk to a number of people who were saying they were going out much less far than they used to go out, even since last year. Somebody said that she used to swim out for hours on end, even up to last year. And this year, she was just going in to about her waist. A lot of people just are having their kids play on the beach in the sand right at the surf and not letting them go all the way in. So yeah, there's definitely a change in behavior, I think, that we're sensing.
I want to ask you quickly about another story you covered for us this week. It's particularly relevant to the news roundup because it has to do with a new newspaper starting up on Cape Cod. It's an unusual event almost anywhere these days, but the people here have a lot of energy and vision. Tell us about this newspaper and the towns it covers.
Yeah, so this weekly paper, it's the brainchild of Ed Miller, formerly of the Provincetown Banner, who's been on this roundup a number of times. There are plans for it to cover Eastham, Wellfleet, Truro, and Provincetown, so those four outer Cape towns. It launched online in mid-August. It's looking to begin printing in October, and they've got a pretty good staff of freelancers so far. So.
The Provincetown Independent, what's the vision for the paper that Ed says makes this unique for the Outer Cape?
Yeah, so he really wants this paper to be something for locals, by locals, and something that you can sense even in looking at the coverage they do. You can really see that it's an Outer Cape paper. He's sourcing a lot of his writers from the local community, and so people reading it may recognize bylines of different people. And they're writing about things that have that distinct Outer Cape feel, so as we noticed, just kind of looking through their website, they've got a metaphysics column. They have a...
You don't see a metaphysics column every day in the newspaper.
Yeah, they've got a metaphysics column. They have a pretty extensive report just about what it's like to give birth on the Outer Cape. Mm. They've got a profile about a Provincetown storyteller. I think they have a column written by maybe somebody who runs a Jamaican person who runs a business out there. And so a lot of things that if you are from the Outer Cape or if you live there part-time, you're going to recognize this as a paper that's reflecting your community back to you.
So you can understand the enthusiasm that might go into starting a new newspaper, but the economics would seem to be daunting. They've got some ideas for how to make this work.
Yeah, yeah. So lots of funding ideas. Of course, the model that they're following isn't new. There are a lot of community newspapers out in California, actually, that have successfully done what Ed is looking to do right now. But basically, they're looking at having part of their newspaper become a nonprofit. They're also looking at being able to take community investors, so the paper will really be a community paper where people own stake in it. And of course, they're really trying to hold more events, be more of like a newspaper that interacts with the public on a more regular basis.
WCAI Sarah Mises-Tan. Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve.
And with us now also in the studio is Eve Zuckoff, our environmental reporter. Eve, your beat is covering the human impacts of climate change across the region. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Steve.
You did a story this week about a new study the town of Falmouth is undertaking around the Surf Drive area. And for anyone who's not familiar with it, describe the area and what's at stake here.
Yeah, that's right. So Surf Drive is kind of on the southeastern coast of Falmouth. And if you drive east down the road from Woods Hole, where our station is, you will pass kind of the sandy beach with the narrow dunes, osprey nests, Shining Sea Bike Path, the town bathhouse. I mean, these are pretty iconic pieces of Falmouth. They're pretty recognizable to anyone who's been here. But the beach is also a really important place. It's just a few feet above sea level, and it's actually a barrier beach, so it protects everything behind it, including salt marsh, homes. And really what's at stake is the future of this road. The town wants to make it more resilient as climate change makes flooding worse in the area. And that's where the story comes in, because it's getting a little hairy.
So they're doing this, they've embarked on a study, and they're trying to identify ways in which they can make this area more resilient, but they're also looking at a whole range of options.
That's right, yeah, and they're really looking at flooding. That's the number one issue here. And everything is on the table when they're dealing with flooding. They're doing climate projections to 2030, 2070, 2100, and the changes could be anything from rerouting Surf Drive, putting it behind the row of houses where it's currently in front of, in between the beach and the homes. And, you know, we don't know yet what's going to happen, especially because there's a lot of really important infrastructure there that may not be movable, that could be movable. And there's also cultural considerations to take into account here. You know, what could we move, but we don't want to because it belongs there, because it's part of the fabric of this place.
It represents such an iconic idea of what Cape Cod looks like in the summer, Surf Drive.
That's
and
right.
To be able to drive along the water there. But if the cost of repairing this year over year continues to rise, the town has to figure out when is it better to invest more upfront? Is that right?
To
make a major intervention that'll last, rather than just kind of keep patching it together with repeated storms.
That's exactly right. And you know, you look back at Hurricane Sandy; it just made a kind of glancing blow to Surf Drive, and there were major repairs. I mean, this road had to be rebuilt, and that's a hurricane that hit 250 miles off. What happens when? And I think it's fair to say when the storm comes here. I mean, is this the infrastructure? Some of these homes aren't on stilts. There's a big question as to how much the town will be ready and prepared to spend in the case of emergency. And maybe doesn't make more sense to look at a bigger bill up front and create what they're calling a phased retreat plan.
And not only the big storm that may come, but also just the repeated flooding. Because you called out in your report, you called out a federal report that's saying that, you know, there could be 20 days of flooding on this road by 10 more years. And then by 2050, which is not that far off, really, it's 30 more years, there could be 100 or more days of flooding each year.
That's exactly right. I mean, this is an area that in the last 2 days I was on Surf Drive and there are cars going through massive puddles. I mean, it was 2 days of rain. This is a road that already I was driving down thinking about, ooh, like if this is happening 10 more days this summer, are they going to have to salt the roads or take the salt off the roads? I mean, there's kind of no end to a low-lying place like this in terms of maintenance and upkeep and repair.
And one other thing to touch on here is that we're talking about Surf Drive, this one little piece of Falmouth, but this is really a big issue for all the towns along the Cape and all the towns along the coast.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think that Falmouth has really been commended by a lot of stakeholders in this story, because they've been described as, you know, they're not sticking their head in the sand here. And there are places all over the Cape. There's downtown Nantucket, there's Sandwich, downtown Sandwich, Chatham Harbor. I mean, these are places that flood all the time. And we've got to start thinking about what comes next for them.
They're definitely flooding more often. And all the research suggests that's going to happen. Eve Zuckoff from WCAI, thank you, Eve, for coming in this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my other guests. We heard from Kristen Young, the Cape Cod Times, Noah Asimo, and Will Sennett at the Vineyard Gazette. We spoke with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Sarah Mises-Tan here at WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.